everyone. Welcome back to the Reformed Fringe.
Take two.
Where we are putting the Reformed back into the fringe, and we are putting the fringe back into the Reformed. Mm-hmm. That's what we like to do, and we think it's necessary. We're two pastors that have been at pastoring for 20 years, and we've both been on quite separate but long journeys into this fringy world after having both come to Reformed theology a long, long time ago. And we kind of see this fringy stuff is adding a like third dimension to a two-dimensional world, or adding color to a black and white TV. Mm-hmm. And I'm old enough to not remember when color came to TV. I'm old enough to watch reruns, but man, I can tell you, Gilligan's Island was so much better in color than it was in black and white, John. So we're your two hosts. With me is John Moffitt. He's pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And I am Doug Van Dorn. I am the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado, kind of near Boulder, Colorado, if you can believe it. And, you know, I guess before we get into this, just always want to mention, if you guys like our show, we would love it if you would subscribe, if you'd tell others, if just send a text. If you found this episode or any of our episodes helpful, text somebody and just let them know that we're there, and give us a like and show us a little love so that we can.
If you're on YouTube, hit that like button.
Especially on YouTube.
It does actually help us.
Yeah. We don't just say that. And, there's no podcasters that just say that. They all mean it. but we try not to throw that out your way a whole lot, but we do want to remind you of it. And we also want to let you know, especially if you're new to this channel, that we have a companion website that we call reformedfringe.com, where we are offering kind of a, we hate saying safe space, but it seems to be kind of the best way to describe it for people that are Reformed Christians or Reformed friendly Christians who might be interested in Reformed theology, but are definitely interested in fringy topics. To be able to go there, it's not public, so you don't get trolls. We kind of guard it for you, and it's a paid site so that you can know that you're not going to have those kind of trolls coming on. But we also offer a whole lot of benefits for you. I think almost every one of my books is up there in PDF if you pay for certain subscription levels, and we have all kinds of articles. We have many different people, about 150 different people in there now. We've got professors, mm-hmm. we've got pastors, we've got laymen, we've got just all kinds of people, and it is a fun community, and we continue to be excited about it and the way that it's growing.
Hey, one other announcement I forgot to put on last week. We have a one-day event coming up
in
October. Yeah, October 30th. Going to be in Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is just south of Franklin, south of Nashville. You're going to be in town for another conference. And so we thought, why not put together, if you're listening to this, you're going to be in the area on October the 30th. We'd love to have you guys here. I believe that is a Thursday night. And you can go to reformfringe.com, and we have a sign-up sheet there. So you can be signed up to get more information. So it'll be at my church. It's going to be limited seats. It can only seat like 220, but really it's like 180 because nobody wants to sit that close to each other. but if you wanted to learn more about that, if you're in the area, I'd love to have you. If you're going to be in the area, we'd love to meet you. We're going to put some more information on there, but that's October 30th. Go to reformfringe.com to learn more. So
should we get into this episode, John?
Let's do it.
You know, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say a couple of, I don't know, days ago, you came out with an article that mm-hmm. you put on your blog called "The Key to Idolatry: Why Access to Other Gods with a Little G." Every other word in your title has capital letters except for two, T-O, and gods. You made sure that had the little G. I love it.
That's right.
Why access to other gods still matters. And we thought it would be helpful for people if we kind of had you lead us through this article, and we have a little bit of a discussion on why you wrote it, what mm-hmm. was going through your head, why do you think it's so important to write an article like this, and how it can help people who are listening to this program.
Yeah. You know, last episode that we did on Ancient Aliens and Ezekiel, we were talking about how we take a modern interpretation of ancient passages And I can't think of, I wish I would have thought of this, Doug, when I asked you that question, but this is probably one that gets retranslated in a modern context probably more than anything. Idols and gods are things we fabricate or things that we, you know, baseball.
So they become synonyms is what you're saying.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly the way it's said. So we think of idols today as golf or my hair or my whatever, or we make gods out of my job or my children or whatever.
Sports or shopping sports. Malls or yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think and I believe that there can be an application there, and that at times the New Testament does allude to this, but in its original form, this is not what was meant. God did not give Moses the Ten Commandments, and he was worried them about turning their staffs into idols or something like that, or their shoes into idols. That's not what was happening at all. So just a little bit about what does it mean that you should have no other gods? What are those? How do we identify that? And then how is that connected to idols? And why are idols such a big deal? All, Doug, throughout the entire Old Testament, idols are an issue, not just like one-off. And then why is that so important that I want to bring this up? What I have found is I've been talking to Christians immediately assume that gods are idols and idols are gods. This is what we do. But that's not the case. And we kind of naturally collapse the two commands down into one. And so I think it's important to understand how it's actually worded. When Exodus chapter 20 and verse 3 gives us the command, is that it says, you shall have no other gods. Now, it's important
so this
that it
is,
says...
This is what we call the first commandment, right? So
that's right.
You're going to the first and second commandments in the out of the 10.
That's right.
Just for clarification for folks.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know if they are put in order of importance, but typically you start with things that are important. And I would say, if he were to put this at the end, it would be weird, because this one is influencing everything that comes next, right? If God is the primary influence, then everything that comes next makes sense. But if God is in competing influences and he puts this at the end, then he's fighting all of this. So it starts in the beginning. You shall not have. And I think it's important here when it says have, the argument that I make in my article is that it does not say create or develop. Have means it assumes prior existence. Right? It assumes prior existence. So
bring to help people for clarification with the second commandment, what does the second commandment say that's different than what you just said here?
Right. So the second one says, you shall not make.
Make. Okay. So one, you should not make, and the other is you shall not have.
Mm-hmm.
So what would having be then?
That's right. Having would be... That language is actually covenantal language. It means you're not supposed to be entering into, because what are the Ten Commandments? The Ten Commandments is covenantal language. This is the covenant between God and his people.
Yeah, they're right? Actually called the 10 words of the covenant.
That's absolutely right. The 10 words of the covenant. So you are not to be having, or because the way that the Old Testament language uses this relationship between God and Israel, it's marital language, right? So you are not to have for yourself an intimate relationship. You're not to be committing yourself to another God, to another being, to another deity. So I alone will be the Lord that is entering into this covenant with you, and I will be the one that to whom you will worship. So you will not have them, meaning that you're not going to be in covenant with them. You're not going to be in worship with them. You're not going to be using them for their power, no matter how small or great they are.
Okay, so it sounds like what you're saying is that... if you were to make, let's say, the Denver Broncos your God, you would have to make them that first before you could have them be that.
That's right. No one sees the Denver Broncos as a God. They just don't.
I fully agree with that, especially these days. Maybe when Peyton or Elway was a quarterback, but not right now.
You got the joke. You got the joke. No, according to what the Israelites would have understood, they knew what gods were. They knew what gods were. They weren't confused on that. They weren't thinking them as these small objects. They thought them to be actual beings because the word, and this goes back to a lot of, you know, so I'm going to assume some work here, but we might as well just pull it out. The way in which the word Elohim is used in the Old Testament, it's identifying a spiritual realm. If I were to reword this, Doug, just to help some people understand this passage, you are not to have or be in relationship or worship any other created spiritual being. That would be a modern translation. Is that fair?
I like that. A created spiritual being. Because it shows it has existence. It shows it's from another realm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
You will not have, you will not enter in with, you will not worship another spiritual being, and all other spiritual beings outside of God are created. So they are created spiritual beings. Now, what you learn very quickly is the second command is very much related to this, to the first command in this way, because it says that you shall not make for yourselves carved images. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. Now, why would you bow down and serve a carved image? And why would you bow to it? Why would you serve it? Well, what people don't understand is how these work. So recently, I used this illustration in my article. Recently, I bought a car for my daughter, and I had the one key fob in my pocket. And after we were done with the transaction, I asked him, do you have any more keys to this car? Because typically there's two. And he goes, oh yeah, there's one in my house. And he goes and he grabs it and brings it back to me. So what's interesting about a key fob in a modern day context is that the key fob is not the car. As a matter of fact, key fobs are pretty worthless in nature as far as like how much material is in them. But the only way I can drive that car and the only access to that car is the key fob, right? And so if he had a key fob and I had a key fob, we both had access to that car, but only one of us owned it, right? And this is almost the language of Genesis 1. I'm sorry, the first commandment in Exodus 20 is that God is saying, you're not going to own, you're not going to participate in being in relationship with them, and you're not going to have access to it. I'm removing the key fobs. You're not allowed to hold on to the keys to the old gods because that's what idols were. They became these access points to where when they bowed down to this idol and they served the idol, it actually interacted with it. How do I know this? Because multiple times in scriptures, we are told this. Let's look over at Deuteronomy 32:17. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they have never known. Well, Paul ends up playing up on this verse and making a connection for us when he's talking about idols as well. This is 1 Corinthians 10:19-20. He says, what do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. He's like, idols aren't anything. They're not. They're nothing. But he goes on to say, no, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to participate with demons. His point was this connection between the idols and worshiping the idols and making sacrifices to the idols is you actually worshiping with demons. And often in the Old Testament, demons and gods are often interplayed with. They're could be synonyms. And so it's like one thing I think is interesting, Doug, if I were to use the words in the Old Testament, you shall have no other demons. Some people would be like, well, that's weird. Why would I want a demon? Because they would take it to be real.
Yeah,
they would
exactly.
Take it to be real.
Exactly.
So the word God is just think of it being spiritual being, whether angels, cherubim, seraphims, demons, that whole realm. You're not supposed to be interacting with them and trusting them and worshiping them. That's the point of the command. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I think a lot of people, when they read the prophets and how the prophets mock the idols as not being real things, and then they're mocking the gods at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They conflate those two things, and they end up denying the real existence of these spiritual beings. And at the same time, they then get in their head that these ancient people were so stupid.
Yep.
So dumb that they actually really thought that if they made something to look like a man, that it somehow became alive or something like that.
Right.
And like that, the chronological snobbery of that, first of all, to think that ancient people were that stupid is really pretty breathtaking.
Yep.
To think about the pride and arrogance of a modern person saying that about an ancient person. And really what they're not understanding is that the prophets are being sarcastic in the way that they're describing the gods as not having real power, because compared to God, they don't. And mm-hmm. so in being sarcastic like that, they're showing the stupidity of worshiping these other entities, because as it says in other places, they are worthless. Mm-hmm. They or false, not that false in there that they don't exist, but false that they are treacherous. They are evil and their power is limited. So why in the world would you turn to something like that when you could turn to the living, true, omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, good, holy God who has created you? Why would you exchange those two things? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So this is a famous passage that's often used when I bring up the gods are real and the idols are not the gods. Psalm 96:5 is often used. You were just referencing this. For all the gods of the peoples are worthless idols. See, John, right there. Well, yes, you could translate it that way. But you, when you look at it, when the Greek translate the same passage, it actually translates as demons, as worthless demons. And the word worthless that's being translated there is the same word that Job uses of his friends. And so is he saying, oh, his friends are, they don't exist.
My three counselors who aren't actually real, they're just in my head making Job like a paranoid schizophrenic or something.
That's right. Worthless meaning they were not giving me good advice. They exist, but they were not helpful. They were actually harming me. And this is the point of the Psalms. Even when the prophets are mocking them, you know, you think about that famous section where they put the wood down there and they pour all the water on it. And then the prophets are cutting themselves and like, you know, where is he? Where is your God? Is he going to the bathroom? Is he taking a nap? And it is an appropriate mockery, because when you think about who these beings are, do they have power and influence? Yes. But in comparative, it is a mockery. Usain Bolt and a 2-year-old, let's put them up to race. Who do you think's going to win? Everybody's like, that's not even a race. That's what they would say, Doug. If ESPN were to commentate on this, they're like, that's not a race. And you're like, that's the point. That's the point of this. Why are you having them? Because they were raised in a culture, in the Egyptian culture, for 400 years. And for 400 years, they had been indoctrinated even before that. I mean, Abraham was a moon worshiper. He was a pagan. As far back as we know, going all the way back to, man, Genesis 6 and Deuteronomy. And you would just have to say Deuteronomy 32 when they divided him amongst the nations. We have idol worship happening since the Tower of Babel, basically. I mean, I'm trying to think about this from a historical standpoint. Because what does Psalm 82 tell us? Psalm 82 tells us that they turned the nations. If you go back and you look at, this is earlier in my article, I'm going to bring this up now. 2 Kings 17, verse 16, it says, and they abandoned all of the commandments of the Lord their God and worshiped, listen to this, all the host of heaven and served Baal. Okay? So the reason why I put this verse in there is that it didn't say they worshiped created beings with their own hands. It said they worshiped the host of heaven. This is another way of saying they worshiped the gods. They worshiped these spiritual beings. What does Paul say? They turned from the creator to the creation. And I don't think he means the physical creation. He means these spiritual beings. So the reason why I wanted to point this out is that if once your brain can go, okay, it is true that the Old Testament creates this absolute insane mockery. This isn't a race. This isn't a competition. You cannot compare God, Yahweh, to these other false gods. And the reason, Doug, I'm going to let you take this over here. It's important for understand, false does not mean not existent. What does false mean?
False means treacherous. It's like when Gollum is using the word false, or the hobbits are using the word false about Gollum. They're not saying he doesn't exist. They're saying that he's false. He's treacherous. You cannot trust him.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Because They are trying to put themselves up and equal with God. They wanted to be him. They want to be worshiped like him. And this goes back to Psalm 82, where it says that they wanted to be worshiped. They wanted to be praised. This is the story of Lucifer, I think, in Isaiah and Ezekiel, where it talks about he wanted to be like the Most High. And so that makes him, what, a false god, because he has left his position. Because you have what's called, he is the God of gods. And I think there he's referencing the loyal angels, because Hebrews, it literally translates that we are made a little lower than the angels. And the word there is Elohim, it's God. So you can go back to my article, you can go look at Doug's book on the angel of the Lord. There's some great stuff on both on how to understand that. And so when they are in loyalty to God, you will notice that they're often just known as Elohim. And when they are opposing him, they're known as false Elohim or false gods, because they have left their position where they belong and they've tried to put themselves in another position. And that's a false, you know, so that would be like you showing up, I don't know, anywhere. And you've never been trained as a police officer. You do not live in the authority of Boulder as a police officer. And you come up and you tell somebody, I'm a police officer. That would be a false claim. Right? You would be a false police officer. And this is, so the reason why I'm belaboring this is because we have put our own interpretations into the text, and it does come from rationalism. It does come from a humanistic modern, you know, I would say anti-supernatural view of scripture. And in doing so, it changes the way you understand the text. And I think it also changes the way in which we understand how this is still influencing us today. So these commands, when it says in the first command, do not have any other gods, it's a legitimate command that we are not to be enthralled with, worship, bow down, or serve. Now, pay attention to that word, serve, because we're going to use this here in a minute, other gods, and we are not to keep access to them. And just like, I don't know how it is in your home, Dave, Doug, but like in our home, I finally created, like, this is where the TV remotes go. Because when I want access to the TV and I sit down, I don't want to look for that
thing. I've tried that many times. And even when I put a string on it, for some reason, the string seems to go away very quickly.
Put a string on it. Dude, that's awesome. You need one of those trackers, you know, like the iPhone trackers. I love my wife, but I put one on her keys because she was always asking me where her keys were. I was like, that's it. I'm putting a tracker on your keys. But yeah, the access to the TV comes through the remote. Okay. So that being said, this is where I might be willing to modernize some of this. So first of all, I think there are real spiritual beings. Do not have them. Do not treat them as you treat me, right? In other words, the command of adultery works here, because how many times did it say Israel is an adulterous nation? How many times did it say that? Not idolatrous, adulterous. Because they broke the covenant with God, which is this like marital covenant, right? And so just like you and I are married and we should not be entering into relationships, we should not have another woman. And Doug, this is why I kind of chuckle, because if God is saying you won't have another one, that means he's comparing them, not one for one, not one for one, that's ridiculous, but he is saying there are some that are like me, being that they're in the spiritual realm, and you will not have them. I don't understand how else you interpret that, right?
Yeah, I mean, when David commits adultery with Bathsheba, she's a real woman. And yeah. I don't understand how you can commit adultery as a nation with another entity. I mean, marriage, being married to Yahweh, Israel being married to Yahweh, is a metaphor that is quite a few places. There's entire prophetic books like Hosea that are written directly to that. And then he even talks about divorcing Israel in both Jeremiah and Isaiah. So what's going on there? Well, there's somehow a spiritual marriage relationship, covenantal relationship between Israel and Yahweh that's real, with two real entities on either side of it. And then somehow Israel is committing adultery with things that don't exist. Like, I don't understand what that even means. So therefore, they have to exist. It's like, I think you bring up unicorns in this article. Like, talk about how you bring that up in the illustration there of why you do that.
Yeah, well, Now you're asking me that on the spot, and I can't remember how I used it. it'll probably come to mind, but yeah, it's a ridiculous illustration where it's like comparing God to a unicorn actually lowers God in his own comparison, which is ridiculous. Which, you know, I was reading this article. I haven't done anything much with it yet, but Gerhardus Voss, in his book on biblical theology, he actually makes this argument, Doug, that if you're comparing, you shall have no other God besides me, that command, and you say that those gods aren't real, you're actually lessening the command and making it of no value. And it actually lowers the personhood of God, because that basically it's not a comparative threat, right? So he's saying that you are not going to take your love off of me and put your love onto something else, which is a legitimate thing to love. Yeah, it's a very interesting argument.
Yeah, to say that, I mean, unicorns, hopefully people recognize that those are not real, mm-hmm. although we could do a show about how they're actually in the Bible. imagine the flying spaghetti monster. You shall have no flying spaghetti monsters before me.
Yeah.
And you say that, and it's like, it becomes ludicrous, because there is no such thing. Everybody knows mm-hmm. there's no such thing.
Right.
Who would even be tempted to do that, because it doesn't exist?
Right. Yeah, you've always used the illustration of, you know, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, and it's like, we would chuckle to say, well, of course I'm not going to bow down to Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. Well, that lowers the actual meaning of the text, and this is not what he's doing. Now, I'm going to make a little bit of a switch here. We got some time, so I'm not worried. I thought we were going to run out, but we got plenty of time. All right, so why is this so important? And I titled this, you know, The Key to Idolatry, which is, it's a little bit of a wordplay, because people are like, why do you want the key to idolatry? That seems a little creepy. It's like, well, you actually are using it, and you may not know it, because to assume that Israel was always under attack and the tactics of the evil ones never changed, all you got to do is read the text. That's not true. You can even see in Scripture how you start to see Genesis 6 attack, then you can see the Deuteronomy 32 attack, and then you can go to the nations and start seeing they are always morphing and changing. And if you're paying attention, you can see how it works all the way into the New Testament, where they've got the scribes and the Pharisees all kinds of messed up in the head. And God, Jesus in the flesh, flat out says to them, you are of the devil. You're of the father, you're devil. So Jesus identifies their tactic and says, I see what you're doing. Like, I know where this comes from. And then the apostles, we're warned in the Old Testament that they're going to start coming as false prophets. And then they're going to start coming as angels of light, and that we got to test the spirit. So we're constantly watching this narrative of how there is a morphing of the tactics that happens. We're not ever told other than that if we walk by Christ, we'll be protected. Outside of that, we're not told how they work other than they're working, right? They're forming and they're working. So what I wanted to do is kind of point out where in my opinion, and Doug, we can dialogue about this. I don't know if we've ever talked about this on the podcast before, but in my opinion, the ultimate aim of the gods and the evil ones and the evil spirits and that whole evil realm is they want to control us. I mean, literally it says you've been moved out of the domain of darkness that you are being controlled by, and you've been delivered from slavery into the kingdom of darkness. I mean, that's not a hard connection to make. They want to control us, right? Now, what's interesting about that is the controlling aspect is they don't want us to be free in Christ. They don't want us to have the joy of Christ, the hope of Christ. So what do? They're going to use any means possible. And I would say throughout history, you've seen it through fear and terror. I would even say through the Dark Ages, they would use mysterious, you know, witchcraft nature of things where people are more enthralled with, you know, wives' tales and mysteries and mythologies. And the American people, well, that doesn't work anymore because we're so smart and we're so wise that, you know, we would never fall for, you know, witch doctory. So they're going to have to use another tactic. And I think the tactics today are probably the most powerful because you don't even know you have key fobs in your heart that are controlling and being controlled by these gods. I'm going to give you some examples. I put these in the article and we can talk about these. But when you start looking at the ancient gods and what they did, like Mammon is alive and well because we're offering security through power and wealth. Like, what are we told by our King, Doug? Set your hearts not where? Not here. Lay up your treasures where? In heaven. And the prosperity gospel is booming. And what is the promise? That you could have health and wealth now, which is the opposite of what Jesus told us. And yet, that's just Christianity. Look at the world in general. Aphrodite? I mean, what does it sell? Love, sex, and body worship through advertising and entertainment. So, I mean, you've done some research on the whole Aphrodite's, haven't you? I thought we had talked about this in a prior episode.
Yeah, I mean, basically what you're doing here is you're going through different kind of divine names or entities or whatever.
Sure.
And showing that they're tied to various vices that humans have. Mm-hmm. I think about the god Eros, mm-hmm. One of the Greek gods. Eros, of course, is a Greek word that means love or lust. So mm-hmm. it becomes the god of sexual excess and stuff like that. Cupid kind of being the Roman equivalent of that. And I think about Paul talking about, don't make your stomach your god. Well, what's mm-hmm. he doing there? I think that he's talking about a human appetite that is embodied by these entities. Somebody like Dionysius really comes to mind with the Bacchae and this dude was the revelry king. He was, mm-hmm. this is what he was all about, food and wine and gluttony. And, so it's like in making your stomach your god, he's saying that you can be bound up not only by your own passions that come from within you, but by entities themselves that somehow are personifying these traits mm-hmm. throughout the mythology of the pantheons of the world. I mean, you have others that are there as well that are worth talking about, I think.
Yeah, yeah. To go back, Molech. If you know anything about the story of Molech and the history behind that, multiple times the Old Testament prophets tell them, do not offer your children to Molech. Why? Because the backstory on that was, you think about the mortality rate of children. They were dying left and right. And the promise apparently is, if you offer your firstborn to Molech, then the rest of your children will be protected and they will be born and healthy. And we don't think about this, but what they were offering them was safety and security because, you know, retirement plans in those days were your children. They took care of you, right? What do we do today? Well, children are a nuisance to my retirement plan. Why? Because they cost money and I don't need them to retire. I don't need them to be sustained. Actually, children become a problem in my life. And so Molech has just changed the tactic. He doesn't care that you kill your firstborn. He wants to take children. He wants to be destructive. And so what's interesting is that some people will say, you guys are just making connections here. You should be careful. And all I'm saying is, if you look at the sins of the Old Testament and the New Testament and how the writers themselves are connecting them to these gods, and these gods are still in effect today, and that the warnings of the New Testament, we're still warned against this. We're still warned against idolatry. We're still warned against giving over the desires of our flesh. And then you have passages that warn us that Satan is a roaring lion seeking whom we may devour, that we'd wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, powers. What do you think these rulers are doing? It's the same rulers. It's the same powers. It's the same authorities. Paul's like, this makes so much more sense to me, Doug, when it says you wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against rulers. What? Rulers who want me to fall in love with money. Rulers who want me to fall in love with sex. Rulers who want to manipulate me to think that I need to have the ease of life, so I'll sacrifice my children. Those ideologies, that is contrary to scripture. He's saying that's what you're wrestling with. And the only way in which you are set free from that is through the work of Christ, because Christ is truth. He's the gospel. You go through the whole armor of God. And so these connections between the gods of old, whether they're the actual entities doing them or not, isn't the point. I'm not trying to identify like, oh, this is Molech. I know it's Molech.
Right,
It's not what I'm doing. It could be anything. It's the work of a satanic kingdom. That's what it is. But what I'm trying to help you understand is that there were names and they were told, don't offer idols to this and don't worship that. And they were naming gods. These were the gods of the Moabites. These are the gods of the Canaanites. Because they were local beings drawing the children of Israel away from the marital relationship that they had with God.
You know, you have in this list Caesar, which I think is super interesting. It made me think of something I don't think I've thought of in this way before. Caesar, of course, is a human being. Julius and Augustus kind of being the first two. And what do they eventually do? Well, they eventually call themselves God. I am God.
That's right.
And the thought that I just had was, if you are somehow in league with the supernatural entities and you're committing adultery with them, and let's just put it in male, female, the God is a male and you be the female in the relationship, then in that marriage, you've married the king and you yourself have become part of that royal family. And it's a way of almost making yourself divine. And we have plenty of examples of humans. Nebuchadnezzar comes to mind, you know, where you basically think that you're a god because you're the most powerful man in the world. But there is an impulse in every human being to want to take true divinity away from God and give it not just to another entity, but ultimately to themselves.
Yeah.
To call ourselves divine, to worship ourselves. And that's probably the ultimate end to what these relationships with these fallen beings do. They might use us, but really people want to be divine. They want to be their own God. They want to be the one who controls their own destiny, makes their own rules. And understanding that these entities are actually real on the other side can actually help you understand how, in a very strange way, it ends up working into you making yourself divine, which is really a kind of a terrifying thought to me.
Yeah, it is for sure. Well, and this has been so helpful for me. Like, you know, in 1 John, when it says, you cannot be a friend of the world and belong to the Lord, either you'll make an enemy of one or you'll basically make yourself the enemy of the Lord. And it's not that, you know, like when people hear world, they think like the physical world. And that's not what he means. He's talking about this kingdom, this domain, this ideology that is encapsulated in pride, arrogancy, and lust and anger. Like this. And so he's saying friend, meaning like friends are people who accept us for who we are and they feel comfortable around us. And he's saying the world can't feel comfortable around you and God at the same time because the two are so opposed. The way he says it in 1 Corinthians 10 is shocking. Because he's talking about cups of blessing, like you are drinking in something that changes you and affects you.
And he uses the language of communion there as well. You're becoming one with them. Communion.
That's right. So yeah, because that was he says you are fellowshipping, you're communing with demons.
It's koinonia.
That's right. Verse 21. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord, okay? So we're talking about this communal cup. We're receiving the blessings and participating with Jesus. And the cup, he doesn't say of idols. He says of demons, which is terrifying to think about. And so there, you are either drinking in, being molded and shaped by, and being developed by Jesus. And according to Paul, if you're not doing that, your alternative is not nothing. Your alternative is you're being molded by demons. You're being molded by the world. And this is where Paul talks about you don't live in a neutral zone. You live in a war zone. So you're either walking by faith, trusting in Christ, or you are being manipulated by the very thing you're not supposed to have. And the evidences of these in your life come out through the ways in which the flesh is involved in them. This is why I love our confession, Doug. Because we're both 1689 London Baptist Confession, wholehearted, love it. And our confession straight up says we have faced three enemies. And in the Reform world, we tend to forget about that third one, and which is why it messes with these type of interpretations. The flesh and the world, man, we're good at that. We are good at pointing that out. The world is bad and our flesh is bad. And it is true. And I've heard people say, well, I don't need any help sinning from Satan. I do well on my own job. And I'm like, you are right. And he knows that. And he makes it worse because the confession is correct when it says the third one is the devil. And this is what I'm trying to get at in this article is that when you remove that concept that there is a legitimate threat and that these gods are real and they're trying to pull our hearts away and there are access to them and they still are coming at us, you've totally removed that third point. and you no longer have that enemy. And Doug, the worst enemy are the ones you don't know about, because they can hurt you in ways. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when you have a leak in your house and you don't know that it's there, but it's so small, it builds up mold, right? And before you know it, you have tons of toxicity coming into your home. This is exactly how the evil one works. He's subtle and he's sly. And if we're not able to identify where he's leaking into our lives, this is why I wrote that article, is that I think it's important for us to understand that we need Christ. We need the preaching of Christ. We need the fellowship of the saints. We need to be using these means so that we can identify the works of the evil one, because they're real. They're not metaphorical, and they're not coming out of our minds. They're coming from real beings. That's my end of my sermon.
I was going to ask you, well, how do you fight these things today? And I think the first answer you actually just gave there, which is that you have to recognize that it's actually something to fight. Mm-hmm. If you don't admit that there's something to fight, then how can you fight it? You have to admit that it's there. What do they teach alcoholics? The very first thing and the most important thing that you can do is admit that you're an alcoholic. Because until you admit that you are an alcoholic, you can't. Why would you even try to fight that? Same thing about being sick. And how many people refuse to go to a doctor when they get really, really sick because they're like, I don't want him to tell me I have cancer. As if telling you you have cancer is going to change it or not change it, right? It's an objective reality. And so if you're going to fight the cancer, you have to at least know that you have the cancer in order to fight the cancer. Yep. And the same thing would be true here. The very first thing that you do to fight against this is to recognize that it's actually possible to be manipulated and used by evil supernatural entities, because they actually exist. And they're real in this world, and they go after Christians, non-Christians.
Yeah, that passage in James. So I preached James as the second book I ever preached as a pastor. So I did John, then James. And that passage haunts me to this day. And I always laugh when I quote it to people, because they honestly, they look on their faces. They don't know what to do. Submit yourselves, therefore, to a God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. What's the implications? He's saying the same thing Paul's saying. He's coming after you. It's not like, if you're not, Doug, think about the logic of that. If you don't submit yourself to the Lord, which then gives you the strength to say no to Satan, he's coming after you. This is why I write these things, because I'm telling you, most people don't think Satan's coming after them. And the evidences start showing up in our lust and anger and our envy and how we prioritize things and what we do with our lives, what we do with our tongues. That's all the evidences of Satan. It's like, oh no, John, that's the depravity. Well, you should tell James that he got it wrong, and Paul, and Peter. So this is the part of the, when I'm talking about putting the fringe back into the Reformed, this is what I'm talking about, that there's a real threat. And man, you and I have talked about, there's so many churches that are being pulverized by Satan's tactics, and we're not using gospel power. This is why I want to put the Reform back into the fringe. A lot of people in the fringe community are identifying these issues. And they're right when they say the church isn't talking about these things. We agree. Now come to Doug and I's church, we are. But we agree. But the problem is, the solutions aren't Jesus Christ and him crucified.
Yeah.
And the sufficiency of the gospel.
That's what I was just going to say, that the solutions are to just talk more and more about the devil, and then somehow, I don't know, to fight him on your own or whatever.
Or use weird tactics. I've heard some weird tactics that are not biblical,
extra biblical, unbiblical sometimes, in order to fight that, when we know that the weapons of our warfare, I mean, we did a whole series on the means of grace for just this reason, that the way that you fight these things are with the power of the gospel, that God gives us very specific power, but very specific places where those are found in the word and sacrament, prayer and fellowship. And, you know, it all starts in a person's individual heart, where they no longer submit to the authority of the world, but they submit to the authority of Christ and of his word and of the power of the gospel and of the truth of the law. And by the Spirit of Christ, then you have the power with the weapons of the warfare that he gave us in, you know, Ephesians 6, which is just a litany of things that come from the Old Testament to be able to fight these things.
Yeah, I want to end here. 1 Peter 4:12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trials when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange was happening to you. I mean, again, Doug, this is language. Why? Because he's saying in this context that when they stand for the king in the kingdom of darkness is going to come and shoot at them. Why? Because we are offering life and freedom and joy in Christ, and there's nothing more than they hate. They legitimately hate that. And so I have to remind my kids and my wife that when we say no to the world and the world's standards and the way in which they conduct themselves, and we get mocked for it, and we get called fundamentalist, and we get called purity culture, and we get called weirdos, and I can't believe you guys, you know, believe in all that craziness. I go and read Peter, and I'm like, I'm not crazy. Peter walked with God. This is God's word. He says, don't be surprised by it, because you live in a world that is contrary to the one that your father has created. So that's why I wanted to create this. I think this article hopefully will help people understand that these commands are legitimate and the war we face is legitimate. And I just want you to connect the gods and the spirits and the angels and the demons of the Old Testament are the ones that Peter and Paul and James are talking about in the new. So there's your connection. All right. That's it. And thanks for listening. We're going to have conversations like this on October 30th, if you can make it, to Spring Hill, Tennessee. Go to reformfringe.com, learn more about that. You're going to learn a lot about Doug and I at reformfringe.com. And we'll talk to you soon.